two things. One is the background here and why I'm talking about this, and the current observational limits of public strings, and then how cosmic superstrings or strings from string theory are different. So the core thing motivating this work, the revival of cosmic strings, is the realization that in the brain inflationary paradigm for inflation, which came out of string theory in the last 5 or 6 years, that the whenever we have the two inflating brains come together to cause inflation, then whenever they collide, what you can get is cosmic strings, these one-dimensional cosmological scale objects produced. And these are exciting because they are from string theory, and therefore, if we could observe them, then we could learn something about string theory directly. And they also, whenever they come out of these models, they come out at a level that is allowed by experiment, but still interesting for observation. One warning for, well, don't, maybe there aren't any string theorists in the audience, but string theorists have completely decided that these will be stable over cosmological time scales yet, but for the interest of argument, we're going to assume that they are in this drawing. So, a bit of background. Cosmic strings have been described as vortices or one-dimensional topological defects that are generically formed in what is known as the Kibble mechanism for defect formation. And what the Kibble mechanism is the recognition that if you have a phase transition that involves a symmetry breaking, and if the symmetry being broken has a certain homotopy group, then there will be various equivalent choices the new phase can make in different areas of space. And if the volume of space undergoing the phase transition is sufficiently large, then different choices will be made in different areas of space. And so when those choices all run into each other, you can have points or lines or walls where the choices cannot be smoothly deformed and run into each other, and you have a remnant of the old phase and a vortex configuration that is called a topological defect. In the cosmic string case, that's a one-dimensional defect. And these are the only kinds of defects that are considered cosmologically safe, don't overclose the universe or cause other problems. And vortices of this kind, through this mechanism, are seen in liquid crystals and are hypothesized to exist in neutron stars as well. So this is just a U1 symmetry. And you can see that the red arrows here are the same red arrows over here in the cosmic string. It's a place in the middle where they can't be smoothly deformed one into the other. So the line along there where the old phase is preserved. So they're very massive. So how massive are they? So there's one parameter that is always used to characterize cosmic strings, and that's G mu, or the dimensionless string tension, or the string tension in Planck units. And this is just the one parameter that characterizes just how heavy these strings are, or conversely, what the mass scale or energy scale at which the symmetry breaking that created them took place. For instance, for something like a gut scale or grand unified theory scale, G mu would be around 10 to the minus 6, just to give you an idea. And that would be in CGS units, 10 to the 22 grams per centimeter. So very heavy. Yes?
What is the typical initial size of these objects?
The Hubble scale. So on average, one will be made for Hubble volume, and it will stretch across that Hubble volume. They don't have ends because they're topological objects.
Yeah.
And so they can't end in space. And so essentially, they all are loops, and that they have to end somewhere.
So you expect that if a phase transition occurred in Minkowski space, you wouldn't have cosmic strings.
As long as it's big to be causally disconnected, they can form defects, which is why you can see them in like a liquid crystal, which is certainly not expanding. It's not the fact that it's expanding isn't what's important. It's the fact that it's the volume of space undergoing the transition is large enough that information cannot flow from one region to another, so as to make sure that all of the volume makes the same phase choice. So that's all that's necessary. It's just a pure statement about information transportation. They're pretty generic, and they really are seen in actual tabletop experiments. So it's a good.
Yes.
All right. Any other questions? Okay. So we have these long linear objects thrashing around in the early universe, and so the first natural question is, how do they interact? So if you have two strings passing by each other, as I have pictured here, there's basically two things that they can do. Nothing. It's just one will pass to the other, or they will interact whenever they get close enough together. The whatever underlying fields preserve them, and they'll change partners. That is, that this end and this end used to be connected, but now after the interaction, they'll change ends. And for gauge theory cosmic strings, this is what always happens. There was never any chance of this other non-interaction to occur. But one of the new things that has come out of the cosmic string theory is that sometimes nothing will happen, and that changes the dynamics of the network or collection of these strings. So, and that's important because what we have to study for studying cosmic strings is not one string at a time, but the cosmic string network, the full collection of all the strings in the cosmos, because these are cosmological objects. And so, and the problem here, the key point here, is that strings are linear objects. And so cosmologically, if you have a linear form of energy, then naively you would expect that its energy density would fall off like one over the scale factor squared. And that is slower than either matter or radiation. And so very quickly, if you have linear forms of energy, you have strings dominating the universe. And that's not what we see. So there must be some mechanism for cosmic strings, if they exist, to lose energy at a rate sufficient to not dominate the universe. And so it turns out that Tom Kibble, whenever he proposed the existence of these on cosmological scales, also proposed the standard solution to this problem. And that is that whenever these strings interact in the way that I described earlier, what they can do is they can form loops, or they can they can come together if there's just one by itself and form a break off a loop like this. Whenever it changes partners, then a small sub-horizon scale loop is formed. And it turns out that these loops are able to radiate gravitational waves very efficiently. And this radiation is sufficiently efficient that the energy is changed from cosmologically dangerous string energy into cosmologically safe background ripples in the fabric of space. And so what happens is that if you have this interaction, then you have the cosmic string network go into a scaling or tractor solution, which that is that the matter density in cosmic strings goes like g nu just by itself with some modification from the interaction probability in both the matter and radiation eras. And so what this means is that as cosmological time goes on, say from cosmological time T1 to cosmological time T2, that the cosmic string network stays, in thermodynamic terms, the same. There's no change to it. It's characterized by the same. If you just took the early box and blew it up, it would be indistinguishable from how the network actually evolved in evolving space.
Is the tension constant?
The tension is constant, yes.
So omega is constant, basically.
Right. So it's constant through each era. It changes in the different areas, but through each era, it stays.
So there can be a transition from one omega in radiation to the
other. Right, yeah. But that's it. So it stays steady, which is good, because it's GU being less than 10 to the minus 6 is cosmologically steady. Now, cosmic strings were originally thought to be interesting because since g mu of 10 to the minus 6 is the operative parameter in the theory, g mu is the operative parameter in the theory, g mu of 10 to the minus 6 is also the same scale, if you think of the cosmic microwave background radiation, of the delta t over t in the C and B is about 10 to the minus 6, characteristically 10 to the minus 5. And so it was originally thought that cosmic strings could be the origin of all structure formation, because they're on the right scale. Unfortunately, though they're on the right scale, they have the wrong spectra. And so this was decided back in 1997. As you can see here, this is the power spectrum data from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey Redshift Survey, and from the WMAP satellite. The orange line is the results from our cosmic string simulation models, and then the dots, the red dots and the purple dots are the data. So clearly, there's a conflict there. So cosmic strings are disallowed to be the source of all perturbations.
Yes. What generates the peak?
Oh, the peak is just, this is right at recombination. It's just that this is sort of the built-up right one, or through the matter radiation equality, and then recombination is sort of it's basically that strings make their biggest contribution right at the time whenever the CMB photons are being released. And so there's a correct, the size of the average string, the average part of the string correlation length at the time whenever the CMB photons are released sets the dominant perturbation scale. And so it was originally thought there would be no peak, but it turns out that there is a peak due to this sort of cosmological history. Any other questions here? So, but now we have an alternate reason for considering cosmic strings, namely, if cosmic strings really do come out of brain inflation, then they could be our very best way of learning directly about string theory, because they would be actual string theory objects existing throughout all of time, sort of preserved, if you will. And so,
yes, oh, that's not. Thank you, question. So there you seem to compare the spectrum, you normalize the whole thing.
Right. Well,
from there, it's awesome.
Right. Yeah. This is the well. Yeah. This is. You have to independently normalize these because you can't normalize the theory has to be normalized separately. And so this is normalized to match here. Actually, these are. Yeah. So this is normalized to match at the shortest length scales. And then over here, this is actually. This particular curve is very close to Kobe normalized. Kobe normalized to be at the degree of this first one. But it's actually normalized so that in the C and B, that it gives the same total power. So that is that if you just integrated out the total power, then both the purple dots and the orange line would give the same total power on the C and B perturbation.
Sorry, I have an even much more negative question. I don't really grasp the physics of the spectrum you have for the CMB, I mean for the string there. So is it easy to understand why it's growing until a certain point and then dropping?
Right. Well, it's just sort of yes. It's so it's just as time goes by. So. The strings make as they go through the primordial plasma, they perturb it by creating waves, basically. And so the waves from the biggest scales are those made at the earliest times. And so as time goes on, then some of these get washed out as time passes. But
then they are released.
And so then the ones that are most recently made,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
whenever the CMB photons are released. But it's a very complicated question. You have to sort of evolve all of the universe's history to get the answer. But I think that gets at the core idea. Mm. Other questions about this? Okay. So but what motivates us to look at these now is this idea that by studying cosmic strings, we can learn about string theory. And so then we have an alternate question to ask of the data, namely, what if we have cosmic strings around, but we don't expect them to explain all of the data, but to be a subdominant component And so then we say, how much can we add? So this is the focus of some work I did with Levin, Rosian, and Ira Watson. And so to do this, we took the string model that we used to make those spectra in the previous graph and added to it and just basically reanalyzed the Sloan and the WMAP data, did a complete from scratch reanalysis of it using their likelihood functions. And in addition to the standard cosmological parameters that they, the plain vanilla six parameter model of the amplitude, the spectral index, et cetera, we added some cosmic string parameters, that is the a weight in cosmic strings, so it's just how heavy are these cosmic strings. That's characterized by this parameter B. And also a string wiggliness parameter, which I'll explain more in a minute, but basically encodes how the how much substructure the cosmic strings have. And so what we do is that we just construct theoretical composite C sub L and power spectra of this galaxy power spectra for comparison to the data, made up of an adiabatic portion and a cosmic string portion. And we combine them in different combinations and using a Markov chain Monte Carlo method to compare them to the data, reanalyze and fit for all of these nine parameters simultaneously and try to determine what the multidimensional posterior distribution function for this nine parameter fit is, so as to learn what we can about the cosmic string. So, and the results of that are in this slide, which is crowded with data. So basically, the upshot is this, that each of these is a one-dimensional marginalized posterior distribution function for each of the nine cosmological parameters listed in the previous slide. And the bottom line is that the standard cosmological parameters are not much affected by the addition of cosmic strings. So let me explain how to read this graph. There's a, for each panel that is a standard cosmological parameter, there are two lines, there's two curves. There's a black curve, a solid black curve, and that is the determination of the parameter, the marginalized PDF for the cosmology, including cosmic strings. And then there's a dashed line that represents that using the same functions and the same analysis techniques, but excluding cosmic strings. So basically, just an exact replication of the analysis done by the SDSS and WMAP team. And where that way we could independently verify that we were doing things right if we got the same answers that they did, if we did. And so then in each of these curves for the cosmology with strings included, we had a shaded region representing the 1 and 2 sigma or 68 and 95% confidence intervals. And so for instance, we find for the omega matter that there's only a very slight shift in the peak and almost no shift in the predicted sort of halfway between the two 1 sigma determination of what omega matter is. The biggest variation is in omega baryon, and even that is just a peak shift of about 1 sigma, so not even statistically significant. So the good news is that you don't have to change this cosmological standard model to account for having strings included. And so, this is a biased parameter. This, I was saying that you have to independently normalize the redshift and CMB data. And so this is the independent renormalization, I should have said. And so just an extra factor that if you're generating both of them from the same code, then you're going to have to take the galaxy redshift data and multiply it by yet another bias parameter. There are good theoretical reasons for why you should do that. And you can break it down into terms that have more physical meaning. But as far as analysis goes, it's just basically another amplitude that you can put in. And so, taking that in hand and seeing that all of these cosmological parameters, Hubble constant up here, redshift to reionization, spectral index, are all pretty much the same, we can go on and look at what we have learned about cosmic strings or how we have limited cosmic strings. And so ultimately, yes?
What happens to the cosmological constant? Do you have any plot for the
cosmological? Oh, well, we actually just to simplify things a little, we assumed a flat universe. So cosmological constant is 1 minus this divided by h squared.
Right, maybe not
have the plus. Well, it's since we've normalized to a flat universe, it's just cosmological constant plus a Magnum matter or one, equals 1. So.
Sure, but I couldn't tell the
right, so we have
much value of h squared. I just wanted to see whether it changes the points.
Oh, no, it would have changed just very little. Yeah. Not point. Yeah, I think I worked it out as something like, I don't remember exactly now, but a percent or two change. So not statistically significant at all.
Can I ask
about, oh, of course.
I just want to ask a stupid question. So just on the understand the shift in the x, just see if I get the picture right. So see if your present class makes things shift the
right.
Value for ns towards the blue.
Right, very sorry.
But your addition of strings, it seemed to me, was adding power to small scale. So,
So I think. Right, I guess that
you're adding a fraction of the strings, then.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is that these things don't. I mean, they come in. The parameters come in several different places, and each of the cosmic string spectrum and the adiabatic spectrum vary differently, with different spectral index. And so, the cosmic string spectrum may offset more the change. A slight change in the spectral index may lead to a bigger change and compensating change. I can't remember exactly how it works for the spectral index. So that's why it's important to do this multi-parameter fit, because you can't just look at it very and then say and guess in advance what it's going to change.
But since we have made more change in the variance, which is again from the same scale as the second peak.
Right, yeah. So that's, I mean, you might expect it to be more important than the variance, and indeed that is one place where things ascendies have changed. Good guess, thank you. And so that's exactly why we have to do it sort of from scratch. We can't. It's hard to guess. So, any other questions about this before? I know there's a lot of data on this slide. But it seems like. And so the main thing that we learn from doing this, or the sort of in one fact, is that you define a parameter f that represents the fractional amount of the primordial power from cosmic strings. Then what you find is that cosmic strings are limited to producing less than 14% of the primordial power. So up to 14% of the primordial power can come from cosmic strings without messing up with it. And so that's the limit. And so here, since we haven't made a detection of cosmic strings, these are just the 1 and 2 sigma are limits. I'm giving an upper bound, but not actual determinations of the best value. An alternate way of looking at this result, if you don't believe cosmic strings exist, is that this is a test for the adiabatic model, how good of a fit to the data it is. And what we've shown by doing this is that you can throw in 14% of something else, cosmic strings, and that the data are fit perfectly well by that combined model, and so that the adiabatic model is picked out uniquely by the data at something like, 85% in some sense. So that's one of my chief results from this work. And another of the results is it sort of comes from that previous result, is to put a direct limit on the cosmic string tension. And so we do this by defining, I was explaining that on that very first data slide that the height or the amplitude of the cosmic string plot that I included there was such that the total amplitude or the total magnitude of perturbation power would be the same as the data. And so that's in fact how we determine what fiducial value for mu to use to normalize our parameter b. And so that's where this I, the power in cosmic string, is equal to the W map for the data power and perturbation power. And so we can then create a PDF of this parameter B and directly extract from it the cosmic string tension limit. And so the cosmic string tension limit then is that at 95% confidence level pictured in the parentheses, GMU is limited to being less than half by 10 to the minus 7, or 5 times 10 to the minus 7, or half times 10 to the minus 6. So that's what I regard as sort of the best data limit on Kalman strings that has been derived yet, the most solid. And the last thing that we can learn from these analyses is about the cosmic string wiggliness. Now, I just gave a very brief definition of this before, but cosmic string wiggliness is essentially a single parameter that characterizes the amount of energy trapped in the small scale structure of cosmic strings. Find that as formula where mu is the bare cosmic string tension, and mu tilde is the observed cosmic string tension whenever you look at them directly through string gravity. And but since this is sort of hard parameter to get at, what we obtain is really just a weak upper bound. Whenever numerical studies of cosmic strings have been done, they estimate a cosmic string wiggliness of around 1.9. And so as you can see, that our limit is something more like 3.6. And so there's a big difference between what the numerical studies suggest is the most likely value on purely theoretical grounds, and then what the data can tell us at this point. So these are all limits. But there's more to studying the gross effects of cosmic strings than just putting limits on their properties. The other thing that you can do, as it turns out, is you can make at least one observational prediction that could be a way of seeing cosmic strings directly in the CMB. And that's through the fact that cosmic strings create B-mode polarization, or odd parity polarization in the CMB. The dominant form of polarization that we expect in the cosmic microwave background is E-mode polarization, or even parity polarization, that comes from Thompson scattering of photons going through scalar perturbation. If you have vector or tensor perturbations, they can give rise to B-mode polarization. And one of the big things that people hope to see is direct measurement of a B-mode polarization from the tensor mode coming out of inflation. That would be from like a gravity wave signal. And so I plotted here in the purple one of a sort of very optimistic value for what the tensor mode contribution to the B mode spectrum would be. And there's also another expected signal in the B mode coming directly from inflation, and that is the fact that so there's a lot of E mode polarization that comes directly from the scalar perturbations after inflation. And since that polarized light has to come to us through the cosmos, and there's lots of things living there, like clusters of galaxies that have shears, then those shear fields can turn E-mode polarization into B-mode polarization. And so we're going to have a lens E to B signal that is represented by this black line. Now, observers say that they can, by very closely studying the intrinsic E-mode polarization, clean out a lot of the E to B lensing. How exactly much is a matter of some debate, but they think that if there's primordial B mode underneath that at a substantial level, then it's possible that it will be seen. And so the point that I'm trying to make here is that if you take the cosmic strings at a level where they're producing 10% of the primordial power, and then you put in two different values for the string wiggliness, 1.9 being the best parameter from numerical studies, and 1.0 being the parameter that gives the greatest magnitude, as it turns out, then you can see that cosmic strings can produce a B-mode spectrum, which I've plotted here, that is comparable to the most optimistic predictions from inflation. And so a signal that could be really observed by the experiments that are being planned now, that are principally concerned with seeing the B-mode out of inflation if it's there, but that could inadvertently discover cosmic strings if they're there to be discovered.
And the other parameters the same in those flows? So the only thing you change is alpha?
We keep the fraction of power and cosmic strings constant. So that means that you have to independently adjust the tension to make sure they go together. They don't have exactly the same.
It's not a trend that if you send alpha to zero, you get more.
Right. Well, alpha can't go lower than one.
You can't.
Right, because it's just a renormalization factor. sort of essentially. And so, anyway, so that's the point here, is that causal change could be seen directly in this way. And just to give some sort of a larger context for where these lines fit in the CMB space, I've taken this plot from the DOE report from CMB research. And you can see the TE line up there, the E mode and polarization line wobbling up there. So you see the cutlet strings are very much sort of in this very this interesting portion of phase space that's going to be, or not phase space, rather, temperature delta T space, where a lot of experiments are going to be looking in there. Everyone's worrying about how to get to this dust and the synchrotron emissions. But so if cutlet strings are there, then they may be seen by accident this way. So with this, I'm concluding the first half of my talk. So if you have any questions about that now, I'd be happy to answer them. Any other questions about the B mode? Okay. So the rest of the time, I'd like to spend on cosmic superstrings, particularly how the strings from cosmic strings from string theory are different from the cosmic strings in general. Everything I've said up till now can apply to gauge theory cosmic strings or to cosmic strings from string theory.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
So you mentioned trying to look after strings with power spectrum and B-mode polarization. What about the non-Gaussian energy?
Right. So the non-Gaussian energy strings is going to be suppressed a lot by the central limit theorem, because essentially any place, since there's a lot of time for strings to pass, a string will pass in each batch of size several times, and it will tend to erase any non-Gaussian signal. And so it's at a lower level. But actually, that's something that I'm working on right now with Levon, or we're talking about doing, is just to quantify exactly how low that contribution is, because they are intrinsically non-Gaussian objects, mm-hmm. obviously. And so it's very possible that they could make a real non-Gaussian signal at a lower level. And so especially with Planck being sort of the ultimate non-Gaussian energy measure experiment, that it's something that I'm interested in finding out. But I don't know the answer right. Question? Okay. So the principal difference with cosmic superstrings, or the cosmic strings from string theory, is that there aren't just one kind. It's not just a single kind of vortex. There are in general at least two different fundamental kinds of cosmic strings that are different. One's the F, so-called F or fundamental string, and then there's the D or Dirichlet string. And so what makes these interesting is that rather than just the changing partners interaction that I described before, that these strings can form bound states. That is, when you get an F string and a D string together, then they can form a third kind of string that was a bound state of the two. And so in general, if you put together P F strings and Q D strings, and you form a bound state known as a PQ string. And so that's what I have pictured here as sort of a binding interaction going on. And so each of these bound states is characterized in the simplest case. And this is somewhat background independent of string theory, background independent, is characterized by this sort of sum of squares formula, where C is the RR scalar. And but the main thing you need to answer, if you have a string network like this with suddenly this brand new aspect, that is, that instead of just having one kind of cosmic string, you have two fundamental kinds of cosmic strings with this brand new interaction. And that question is, do these still go to scaling? And if they do go to scaling, they have these higher tension states that are available to them. Is there some way of controlling the tension at an upper, to put an upper bound on the tension? Are they still under control, or do you have a danger of frustration or some other kind of UV catastrophe? And so this has been, answering that question has been a big focus of some work I did the last year. And so, to answer that question, to get our hands around these new dynamics, we had to make a couple of assumptions. The first assumption we made is that, so you can see the cosmic string binding here in a slightly propagandistic way. the basic assumptions are, the first is that if these are energy-losing reactions, which we think that they will be in general, then the binding will take place quickly as compared to cosmological timescales. That is to say, that every kind of, every different species of cosmic string, every different tension state, every different combination of P and Q will all still have be characterized by the same sorts of correlation lengths. That you won't have the old PF strings that come directly out of inflation being long and the new bound states being short. So this is a simplifying assumption that we found was necessary to build a tractable analytical model for these. And the second assumption that we made is that for every combination of P and Q that can interact, that in general you might expect that a 5-7 string and a 2-2 string would interact in a different way than an F string and a D string. That is, that there would be a different probability of interaction between the two. But to make, again, the problem tractable, we just assume that F, the single parameter right in front here of this formula that I'm about to explain, the interaction probability for any two kinds of strings that are not of the same kind is a constant for every kind of string and not dependent on velocity. And we'd like to loosen those assumptions later, but for our first pass at the problem, we thought that would be a good simplifying assumption to make. And so taking those assumptions in hand, we construct this rate equation for the population states, or the number densities of each different species of cosmic string, where the Greek letters here represent a particular combination of P and Q. And so we have a creation term where two other kinds of strings get together and make an alpha string, and then an annihilation term where an alpha string and another kind of string go to some third kind of string state and it's lost the alpha string number density. And so in addition to this formula, we adopt some interaction rules from some string theorists who study these interactions, where we know that the values of P and Q have to be co-primed to be stable. That is, that if you have a common divisor between P and Q, then in fact you won't have a bound state, but you'll have two BPS states of strings. So for instance, if you had a 2-2 string, two F strings and two D strings, that 2 and 2 are obviously both commonly divisible by 2. So what you would not have is not in fact a 2-2 string, but a pair of 1-1 strings that are just right on top of each other, and they wouldn't be interacting. And so by the same mechanism, then you can't have multiple winding numbers, that you have 5 F strings or 5 D strings right on top of each other, they're BPS with respect to each other, and not bound states. And then again, that all of the interactions are energy losing. So taking all those assumptions, we want to ask the question, do these networks go to scaling, and are their tensions controlled? And so we had to, but if you can't just ask that with one equation, we had to construct a full model, a full analytical model for them. And so I did this with my advisor, and so what I did was we took the a velocity-dependent one-scale model for cosmic strings that had been suggested by Martens and Shellard, which were basically what they had realized is that if you include a term for the velocity of the cosmic strings, the large-scale velocity of the cosmic strings, you can get better fits to numerical simulations. And then we constructed a model around that where every kind of string is, as I said, characterized by a single correlation. That is, every different species has the same sort of average length of straightness. And then where every different tension state or combination of PQ is characterized by its own number density. And so these number densities can evolve through just dynamical things like dilution from expansion and from the fact that a curved string is likely to straighten. And then they can also evolve through the breakups and reactions with other with different PQ states, as I described in the previous slide. And then very importantly, or in continuity with old cosmic string physics, they can also self-intersect and make these loops that were so important for keeping cosmic strings cosmologically viable before. And so in this model, we have basically two adjustable parameters that aren't unknown, and that is the probability of self-intersection, P, and the probability of inter-string interaction, F. And this is a simplification. And then we set our there are other constants, C2 and C1 in theory, that we've set using basically adopting numbers from numerical studies of cosmic string networks. So we adopt this model, and then we started working. So the two things we were worrying about, I was telling you about possible UV catastrophes. And so now we have a way of quantifying this. So one is if you take P to be too low, that is if cosmic strings don't interact with themselves well enough, then what happens is that there's no way for any individual kind of string, we thought, to lose energy. That is that if you have a single string, like just a regular cosmic string, and it can't interact with anything, then we have that same problem that I described at the beginning. And the network goes to frustration and dominates, you know. But now there's a new problem, and that is if strings of different kinds interact, but only very occasionally, which is a very weak interaction, then you have this another problem where you can start populating all, lots of different tension states. You can have, you know, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 2, 1, 2, 2, all of these different PQ combinations. And if each of those combinations goes to scaling separately, and you have so many different states that in the end, you have many different sort of parallel cosmic string networks all on top of each other. And again, you get a UV catastrophe. Because if each of those tension states go to scaling by itself, what scaling means is that this combination of omega cosmic strings over its tension is constant. And so and you need to sum over all the different tensions. And as you get more and more tensions, you can get far too many cosmic strings. So, but the good news is that for a wide range of reasonable parameters for F and P, that the networks described by these analytic equations do in fact go to scale. So let me just explain this plot. This is the omega and cosmic strings, sort of appropriately normalized, and summed over all the different string tensions. And so scaling here is where omega cosmic strings go settles to a flat, and or whenever this parameter up here governs how well it's converged, and so that's safely going down towards zero in all these cases. And so they do go to scaling, and surprisingly, they go to scaling even if you turn off loop formation, so that all you have is strings of different kinds interacting and binding. It turns out that under the assumptions of our model, then those networks still lose enough energy to go to scaling. So this is a brand new result from our work, that this is unexpected, that this could possibly happen. And the other main result of this work is that there are very few tension states populated. Very few combinations of P and Q actually develop substantial number densities. And where each of these, so that is, if this along this axis is the logarithmic scale, the number density in a particular combination of P and Q, or the tension, and of course, then the tension is plotted along the x-axis here. And so, and each little dot represents the population in that particular tension state. And so, you can see that by far the dominant states are the free states 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1. And so everything else is drastically suppressed. And the next biggest population is down by an order of magnitude, and then again by another order of magnitude to get to the next. And so we've safely averted both of the different catastrophes that you could find with this model. So that's really good news, and that means that it's worth continuing to look for cosmic strings in brain models of inflation, because they're not going to ruin your cosmology. So with that sort of having been conquered, What I'm studying right now actually is, I was talking about wanting to loosen those assumptions or at least test them. And so right now, what I'm doing is trying to see if cosmic strings really do bind that as fast as we assume. Or it's safe to assume that there's only one characteristic length scale for a cosmic string network. And so what we're doing then is we've taken a gauge theory model. A gauge theory model for cosmic strings characterized by binding an interacting potential for basically about two scalar fields rather than one scalar field in a U1 gauge theory. And so in this sort of toy model, we can then make vortices of two different kinds that will bind up if they interact. So we'll go to a lower energy state by binding. And so then we can study them dynamically by adapting gauge theory code for studying vortices and just have two different kinds of vortices interact, bind up, and watch the dynamics evolve in numerically. And so that's the work that's the work I'm doing right now. And so the last thing I'd like to talk about is related to another bit of work I've been doing, and also with the most famous failed case of cosmic string observation. And that has to do with cosmic string gravitational lensing. Now, cosmic strings are gravitational lenses because whenever you have a cosmic string, it turns out that rather than making a gravitational field of the normal kind, they actually create a conical space-time. It's the equivalent of cutting a wedge out of space and reattaching the edges so that, as you can see in this image, that where before there were parallel lines, if the two parallel lines go around the cosmic string, so after that they are bent towards each other and intersect. And this, the deficit angle, the missing angle of the cone, is related to G mu in this way. And so for instance, if you had some astronomical object behind a cosmic string, then if there were a cosmic string between you, then you would see two identical copies of that object right next to each other on the sky, because the light would have been just geometrically able to travel on either side of the cosmic string and reach you without any distortion. In fact, they're straight lines; it's all flat space. Because of the large scale properties of space time, both geodesics reach you. And so this is very interesting. It would be a very clear cut signal for a cosmic string if it exists. And it's still interesting, even though there's been lots of study of looking for gravitational lenses. But the reason why this is still very much interesting is because right now, for cosmic string tension at around the level, at the upper bound allowed by cosmological experiments, what that corresponds to is an image simulation of one arc second. And right now, something like the Hubble Space Telescope, or the very best telescopes, have resolutions of about a tenth of an arc second. But those are not, the Hubble Space Telescope doesn't do surveys. It looks at particular places in the sky. And the survey telescopes are such that they're able to see things with resolutions around one arc second or smaller. In other words, it's only now that astronomical observations are going to be at the level where you could expect to see cosmic string lensing if it's there. And so if cosmic strings are around this level, then we could start uncovering lots of them in the near future, possibly. But this is a bit of a simple story, but it turns out that all of these things are changed if the strings are moving, or if they're turned towards you at a funny angle. And so with Binchler recently, finally just sat down and worked out what the general formula would be for the deficit angle with a cosmic string at an arbitrary angle with respect to you and moving at an arbitrary velocity. So I won't go through that, it's a bit painful, but just wanted to write it down for you so you can see. Oh, sorry. Yeah, this is just the geometric factor for the distance from to the source from the cosmic string and the distance from the source to the observer. So it's just a geometric effect that essentially says that the apparent angle depends on the relative location of the string and how far away the object is. Sorry, I sort of forgot to say that. Thank you. And so the reason that motivated Vin and me to look at this is that obviously if you have these vertices, these binding places, then the old double image, double identical image picture that would be so distinctive for complex strings is going to be enlarged. And in fact, so it turns out that if you have a place where a 1-0, a 0-1, and a 1-1 string are coming together, say, or any, but these could be any combination of P and Q, then what you get is, in fact, a triple image, all of them identical. And this is a simulated image, obviously. We didn't go out and look for this. But the reason why I've shown this is that it really would look something like this. If you look at it in the sky, there would really be sharp edges because it's a purely geometrical effect. There's no distortion. It's just seeing the same patch of the sky, seeing the same area of the sky through three different geometrically equivalent paths. And so it would be a very dramatic thing to see, and this would be a smoking gun for the existence of cosmic superstrings, if you could ever see one of these. Probably quite rare, but and what we think of as the best hope of seeing this is if these new surveys were able to start seeing cosmic string lenses with some regularity. And if you could track them, then perhaps if you track the sync, if you could, were able through optical lensing and through cosmic microwave background studies to find this, follow a string long enough that if they're doing this binding, then maybe you could find the binding vertex somewhere along the length of the string and see something like this. And we'd all be very happy.
So what would be the typical observation, the time scale which you would have to do these surveys in order to be sure to see such?
Well, these are cosmological distances. So if you can have a string of the object at a redshift of something like a half, and the cosmic string at a redshift is like a third, and that's what you're talking about. So they're not, as far as their angular motion, it's extremely slow. And so you don't have to worry about being in a hurry. We would have noticed if there were cosmic strings close to us by now. So they're probably a sort of cosmological distances. And so they're not moving on human lifetime timescales. But there's more of a story to that I can tell you more about that. And so, but just to close, as I run out of time, some of you may have heard that there was a reported putative cosmic string lensing event. It's called CSL1, discovered by Sodden et al. And it was very exciting because, as you can see here, this is the spectrum for these. So they saw these two, this double image here. There's two very seemingly identical looking galaxies right next to each other, right along this almost identical spectra that you can see here, perhaps not analyzed here. And so this is like a really good candidate for a cosmic string lens. But last week, sadly, the Hubble Space Telescope looked again with much higher resolution at this object and discovered that, in fact, it was just two giant elliptical galaxies that, as you can, to the naked eye, it's obvious that these aren't identical things. They have a slightly different geometry. And so if it's lensing, it's not the simple cosmic string lensing that we were hoping it was. And it's probably just two interacting galaxies. And so it's just a bit of a cautionary tale that these observations are hard to do. But this was very exciting and sort of crushing to learn that it's not true. But it's as I was saying, this is still at the state of the art. And so it's not, seeing this isn't ruled out by any means, but just not this case. So you can go tell anyone that you know that was excited about this, that not to be excited anymore.
It's not possible that there were some foregrounds from such that.
Well, not this much. And the thing is that, I mean, you might be able to.
The images are really distinct.
Right, they really are distinct. I mean, the thing is that once you start really having to cook up the story a lot, then no one believes you anymore. I mean, no one believes anyone in the first place. But once it's not clearly undistorted image, identical images, then you lose interest because it has to be very crystal clear before it's a real discovery.
In the case of the three. Is it possible to get anything similar for any other kind of
Well, Maybe there are you can dream up gauge theories that will make vertices like an SUM gauge theory.
But it's still strings.
Right, but you can make strings that would have vertices. Yeah, no, but you certainly can't. A triple image, there's nothing that can make three identical images. All of standard gravitational lensing distorts the images for one thing, and it distorts them badly in general. And also, it does in fact always make odd numbers of images. So getting three images wouldn't be that surprising, but they would never be the same brightness, and they would all be heavily distorted. And so, if you saw three same brightness undistorted images, there's nothing else it can be. And so, just as my time runs out, I conclude by reminding you that cosmic strings could have made up 10% of the primordial, 14%. Of the primordial perturbations without messing up any of the current data we have. So they could be out there. And if they are out there, they can make a big B-mode contribution to the CMB. So watch for that. That cosmic superstrings could make networks of PQ strings that are cosmologically safe with few tension states populated and so that scaling successfully under what I think are very reasonable assumptions. And that they have distinct observational signatures, and that all cosmic strings can be seen through gravitational lensing. And one thing I didn't have time to talk about, which is direct creation of gravity waves. So the gravity wave picture may be changed in the case of cosmic superstrings. So that's it. Thank you very much. Other questions?
Do you want to make any signaling in the case of
lensing?
How do you mean? What you show is so far as
those. Right. Well, that's sort of what they do. Is if they're there, then they have this conical spacecraft, so then they double in the images. And if they're not there, they don't do anything. So they don't actually have a Newtonian. In general, a straight string has no Newtonian potential.
Okay.
And so it doesn't distort. Though I will say that in the case of a Wibley string, that there is a Wibley string because the energy is in kinetic energy, essentially. It has a Newtonian potential. And so those could distort at some level. Other questions? All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Sure.